This is an oral history interview with Jacqueline Lino Grant, who is the former director of the Native American Program at Eastern Oregon University. The date is July 21st, 2006. Could you tell me your full name, where and when you were born, and that sort of thing?
My full name is Jacqueline Colleen Lino Grant, and I was born in Portland, Oregon, in 1953, April 12th. I'm the oldest of five children, and my father is enrolled member of Grand Ronde. We're of the Rogue River Umpqua bands of Indians, and my mother is Norwegian.
Now, we'll go into this later, but at the time you were born, was the Grand Ronde tribe already terminated by the government?
Let's see. They were terminated officially in 1954, but when I went to live, my father, when he found out about me and married my mom in December of 53, then we went to the Grand Ronde Reservation. And it was always considered a reservation, even though shortly after that it became, you know, that was the termination time. They were going through that right at that time.
So you lived on the reservation then as you were growing up?
Mm-hmm. That's where I grew up.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And where did you go to school? Your formal education?
Formal education. Elementary and secondary was at the Grand Ronde Elementary School. It was the same school that my dad had gone to, and it was an old two-story schoolhouse. And then we moved to Tillamook, Oregon, so I did some of my junior high school there, and then graduated from Portland. Went back to Portland and actually graduated from Reynolds District, High School District.
Then, you graduated from Eastern Oregon University.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Tell us briefly about your college background then.
Well, I wasn't prepared for college, and so I didn't really know that I'd ever be a college student. But my husband, he was a very good mentor, and he was a college student. And so really when I met him, he kind of urged me to think about college, and so I tried out a summer term at Mount Hood Community College, and then I tried out a fall term at Central Oregon Community College, where I had a Native American advisor. His name was Pete Azier. He was an Alaskan Native man, and Pete one day came down and found me and said, you know, your grades are good enough. You need to either decide to go to a four-year university or a college, or, you know, do something, because, you know, I was exhausting classes, or he knew that I would do well if I moved on after that one term. I thought, boy, that was interesting. So I came to Eastern, and Steve was transferring to Eastern Oregon University. I think it was Eastern Oregon State College at the time, and Steve started school right away. He started in the winter 1973 and had transferred from Southern Oregon University. And then I started in 74 and just went that one year at Eastern and had a great advisor. Again, I didn't have a really good high school education. I wasn't college material, I don't think. People didn't really view me as college material. And so I really didn't take the challenging courses that I should have took. So when I got to Eastern, I had a wonderful teacher and mentor. Her name was Leora Hug, and I think she's a Union County resident, lifetime resident, and she coached me and helped me learn how to read at the college level and do college, you know, all the tricks that students learn to be a good college student. So that's kind of how it started. But after that one year, then I left the program. I left because my husband graduated, and I really wasn't connected in with any particular group or club, or hadn't really connected with the college, I guess you would say.
When did you return to college and finish that degree?
It was 1986. It was 11 years later. And we were living in Wallowa County, and had gone up there and went to Willamette County just because our little savings couldn't get us a house in Union County at the time. And so we took our nest egg and bought a house in Willamette County and had three children. And our youngest, Jack, he was 2.5 when I came back to school and decided, oh, I'm going to finish that degree. So, 1986.
What is your degree in?
It's psychology and with some business. I never did finish the business minor, but I did take some business classes. And
when did you graduate?
In 1989.
Now, tell us about your husband, Steve, briefly. You met him before you came to mm-hmm. Eastern Oregon, you said.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Give us a rundown on your husband.
Yeah, I met Steve in Tillamook, actually. He was paying his own way through college, so he would go 2 terms, winter and spring, and he worked 2 terms, fall and summer and fall. So he took him 6 years to complete his degree. But he was at Southern when I met him, and so I met him in Tillamook because that's where his dad was building houses, and I was back there working. And then when he left to go back to Southern Oregon, he asked me to go down there with him, and so I did, and so I really just kind of followed him around, I think, because I thought, oh, this might be the real thing here. And we did. We ended up coming to Eastern together and Eastern Oregon, and like I said, the winter of 1973, and we stayed. I think we've taken a year off here and there throughout that time, but we always keep returning to La Grande and to Union County.
Did you marry him after you came to La Grande, or were you married before you moved to Union County?
We got married in 1972 after we'd been in La Grande for, I think we were together for almost 4 years before we got married. So yeah, it was after I think we were married in Weezer, Idaho, just because we didn't like Oregon's rules on, we had to do something special in Oregon or had to wait. So we just drove to Idaho and got married in Weezer one weekend and then had a big party later.
I see. Now, your husband still has a business here in Union County. Can you tell us a little bit about that? The name of the business, what it's about?
Yeah.
And your husband's name, and too, I guess.
My husband's name is Steve Grant. He's from Central Oregon, grew up in Madras, Oregon. And yes, he was, he's a college graduate, graduated from Eastern Oregon State College in 1975, and with a science mathematics degree. And his dad, Jiggs Grant, did not want him to be a builder. But lo and behold, when you got to pay the bills, you go back to what you know. And so he'd always done odd jobs, and then we decided to do this business. It's JLG, the initials, JLG, and actually they're my initials, but they were actually Steve's dad's initials as well. And we got the business going in La Grande, and that's what fed our family while we were in Union County all these years, and it's where our son's in the business, Joaquin, and so it's a long-term kind of thing. It's what kept all of us here, I think, and in Union County is that building business.
And it's JLG.
It's a home construction, home contracting business. Yeah, build new houses and remodeling. And of course, during the hard times in Eastern Oregon and Willamette County, particularly, you know, you had to do that on the side and then have another job because you know people didn't have the money to even remodel. So, yeah.
So when did that business begin?
You know, I think we were...
Sorry. We were talking about when the business began.
I think we got our business license and all of that in about... I should have asked Steve, because he'll know this. He would know this exactly. But I want to say 19... It's about 30 years, so what's 30 years from now?
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, probably about 76.
76 or somewhere. Yeah, we were married in 76, so I think it was right about that same time. Mm-hmm. 75, 76, so.
Okay. And what is your function with the business? What do you do with the business now other than lend your initials and your father-in-law's initials?
Initials. when I first started out, I actually helped with the work, you know, roofing work, cleanup work, was learning a little bit about the trade. But now, after having the kids, I didn't really like taking them out on the job sites, and it wasn't always the safest place for little kids to be running around. So I just do the books and keep track of all the, you know, just the paperwork part. Yeah.
Then you periodically return to Union County now that you're living in Grand Ronde now, but how often do you come back then, and what do you do when, are you dealing in the business when you come back?
Yes, I probably come back once every couple of weeks, yeah, pay the bills, try to keep the books up. I'm not doing the greatest job because it's at a distance, you don't do as well, but, and just help out where I can. Our son's building a house now, and so we've got a job going in Imbler right now. Steve and Joaquin are on that job, and then they've got a house job up here by the campus on 5th Street, off of 5th Street.
So does your husband still, does he stay here longer because of this business?
Yeah.
Is he actually living here?
Yeah, he lives here, and I live down there. So we have this, sometimes he'll come down there if he can, but summertime's a busy time for the building business, so he doesn't get away as much as I can get away. So, yeah, we're doing the long-distance commute thing.
Does JLG have an office of its own, or does it operate out of a home?
Yeah, it operates out of a home, yeah. We're a small, just family business, so, yeah.
Okay, the next area I want to talk about with you is... your involvement with the Native American program as a student, or before you became the director of that program. What was your involvement then?
When I started as a student in 1986, I also got a half-time job as a secretary assistant with the Native American program. And I didn't really intend for that to happen, but the person that was in the position, Lorena Thompson, who from Umatilla, she was in her senior year, and she had told her boss and then my boss, Joan Jackson, that she really wanted to concentrate her senior year and make sure everything was in order with her grades, and she was a very good student, and she really wanted just to dedicate herself to her studies. So this opening half-time job came open. And as a secretary for the program, then, you know, you had an opportunity. At that time, the secretary took notes for the Spilia Club. And Spilia Club had a lot of files, and there was just a lot of interaction between the program and the club. And they were almost, you know, they were very much connected. So that I got involved with the club in that way. And I served 1 year as the president of the Spilia Club, again, while I was going to school. So I worked half-time and then went to school full-time. And did that all through the summer, 3 straight years, summer included, so I could get done, basically.
What other things did you do? Tell us about Spilia at that time.
It was a great club. We weren't really, there wasn't a large... enrollment in the club at that time, or a large enrollment of students that could be identified as Native American in the, at Eastern Oregon State College at that time. I think, I want to say there was around between 36 and 42 students that we could actually identify. And so, and I would say maybe six to eight of those students were really involved in the club. Very active. They did the spring powwow. It used to be called the spring root feast, and it later it went to the spring powwow. Its name changed. They did events on campus for cultural awareness. Talks went out to elementary and secondary schools and did, you know, presentations for young kids. They were very, just really a good, active organization. And one of Eastern Oregon State College's oldest clubs and organization, I think the Rodeo Club was another one that had maybe been formed around the same time.
It's my understanding that SPELIA, or the Native American program here, is also one of the oldest programs maybe on the West Coast or mm-hmm. more in the United
mm-hmm.
States.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we're talking about when you worked for this program, that probably would have been in the 80s then.
Yes.
Were you involved with SPELIA or Native American program in the brief time you were here in the 70s?
In the 70s, I wasn't. I did not, for some reason, I didn't get connected in. Number one, I couldn't find their office. And I wasn't sure. No one really directed me to look them up or, you know, kind of connect in there. So I didn't get involved, although I saw a few brown faces on campus at the time and was kind of curious about, oh, well, where are they or where did they go, but I could never really find them. So I didn't get involved in the 70s.
Okay. Who was the program director when you worked for Native American program?
Her name is Joan Jackson, and she was a professor at Eastern Oregon University or Eastern Oregon State College. And she also directed the counseling program, and I think she had testing. She had testing and testing services, counseling program, and the Native American program.
You said maybe about 30 people were involved at that time. Mm-hmm. What tribes did they come from?
The wonderful thing about Eastern Oregon State College, I think, for the Native students, and probably all students, but they came from everywhere because one of the reasons we didn't have out-of-state tuition. And so we had Alaskan Native students, we had students, most of the largest populations of students came from Umatilla, just over the hill, Yakima students, and Warm Springs students. And in fact, probably when the program, in the 70s, the height of their enrollments was like 100 students going to school at Eastern Oregon State College. In the 70s.
100 Native American
uh-huh,
students.
Yes, and most of those students came from those three reservations, the Warm Springs, the Umatilla, and the Yakima tribes. So.
Then how long did you hold this position as the secretary of the program?
Yeah, when I graduated in 1989, I left the position, and it was because of my experience that I got in the at Eastern and in the Native American program. I landed my first job at Lewis Clark State College in Lewiston, Idaho, as to develop a program. And so I applied and got an interview and got the job. So we kind of trudged over there. We were there for 1 year. Would have liked to have stayed longer, but at that time, my husband's, here we have this building business, and we're very much connected to Union County, and so then he's making twice a week trips. So he would come home on Wednesday nights, come to Lewiston on Wednesday night, and then go back to work over here for Wallowa County on Thursday, and then come back home to Lewiston on Friday. So we did that for 1 year. And all of our kids, of course, we had the youngest in daycare and the other two in school and then after school programs. And I was trying to hold down this new job, plus kind of have most of the child rearing, you know, work. So we decided after a year, well, maybe that was a little bit too much to bite off. And so we came back to Union County.
I see. Now, you were saying that originally the annual event that the SPELIA put on was the Spring Root Feast.
Mm-hmm.
What did that involve? What was that about?
It was a it was a wonderful program. Steve and I just got to attend it. We didn't, again, we weren't going to school here. We just came up for the program. But what I understand was elders from the Umatilla tribe and possibly from the Warm Springs tribe and Yakima tribes would come over. Students actually went out and dug the roots. They helped, they showed them, you know, how to dig the roots, and some of the students obviously knew how, but everyone was invited to come and they cleaned the roots. There's pictures in our office, in the old Native American program office, that have the students have all the roots out there, and it was very traditional, it, you know, like you would do at a longhouse on a reservation. And so there was, yes, the lots of ceremonies and the blessings of the first foods and the first roots and how things were lined up. And it was a wonderful way for Native culture to be happening on a college campus. And I think it was probably one of the first in Oregon to be doing something like that.
How many people would attend that?
Oh my gosh, it was up there in the student center, what we used to call Hoke Center, on the second floor. And the year that we attended, there was hardly room to even dance, the drums and the people, and it was just jammed packed.
So would they begin with like a grand entry thing,
mm-hmm, yes,
and then move into the feasting portion itself,
mm-hmm,
through ceremony? Did they do drumming and singing?
They
for,
did drum
mm-hmm, before the meal.
Yes, they did drumming. They did, you know, the prayer and the drum song before the meal. They would have the meal, and then they went into the dancing. And I don't know how much of a competition Eastern. This spring powwow has not ever been a huge competition because it not had a lot of money, you know, connected with it. But it was the kind of a powwow, I think, where people came to honor, number one, the culture of Native peoples. And it was a diverse group because you'd have Alaskan Native students. A lot of the students came from Chemawa Indian School in Salem, Oregon, and they were from all different tribes. So there was that sharing of cultures, but they followed kind of the traditions of the High Plateau peoples that are in this area, the Yakima, Nez Perce, Warm Springs, Umatilla. So I think that, you know, they would have dancing competitions and you might get a little prize money, but and then they would, of course, they had the grand entry, and then of course they retired the flags. It was pretty much, you know, kind of traditional as how they do powwows now.
Had this been going on for a while before you came into it?
You know, I think they got the program. Three professors actually wrote the grant to get the Native American program. It was called the Indian Education Institute at that time. In 1969, three professors at Eastern wrote this grant and to get this program going. And when the grant was awarded, probably the 69-70 year or 70-71, so it went. I think we only came to the root feast a couple of years, but I'm not sure. I'm supposing that it went on. When I came back in 86, it had changed from the root feast in the 70s to in the 80s was just the spring powwow, and we didn't go out and dig the roots and prepare the roots or any of that. And I'm not sure why that change took place, but we could probably ask some people and find out. But I do know a change took place.
Now, did you participate in this festival at that time, or you said you and your husband maybe came and went to the feast?
Yeah, we went to the feast and watched the drumming and dancing. Where I grew up, in a terminated tribe, we didn't really practice the drumming and dancing part of what is a part of Native culture, what people normally would think of a part of Native culture. We were more, I don't want to say underground with our Indianness, if you will, but maybe that's part of it. Certain things you did practice, story time telling, values, belief systems, value systems, you know, those were something that the government couldn't take away, because those are things you hold inside of yourself. But the external display of Indianness, or what people want to kind of sometimes associate with Indianness. So I hadn't seen a lot of dancing and drumming, and so found it pretty fascinating, I think, at the time, but didn't dance. I wouldn't consider myself a dancer, although I know a few things to know how to do, the social dancing and the welcome round dance and things like that.
Let's talk about when you came into the directorship of the Native American program.
Mm-hmm.
When did that take place?
The summer of 19... Well, let's see. I was in Lewiston for 1 year, so 89, 90, 91. And when Dick Stenard, he was the dean of students when I left Eastern. In fact, he became the dean of students shortly after I came in 1986, and we became pretty close friends. And so when I left, he was very happy for me to go to Lewiston and kind of spread my wings and get more experience. But when he heard I was coming back, they actually called and offered me the directorship, because in that interim, my supervisor, Joan Jackson, had gone back. Actually, in my senior year, I ran the whole program because she left and took a sabbatical to go to get her doctorate and finish up her doctorate work, and which was a wonderful opportunity for her. It was a great opportunity for me because I didn't get the pay that she got to do the program, but I really didn't really care about that. What I thought, this would be a great opportunity to, you know, actually run a program, do the budgeting, all of that. So my senior year, I was finishing up as a senior and doing the program, kind of co or interim director, if you will, and then gave me a chance, I think, for Dick Stenard to kind of see what I could do. And so when he heard I was coming back to LeGrand, and Steve and I were moving our family back to Union County, then he called and said, this opening, we want you to apply for the directorship.
Now, was it still called the Institute then, or
no,
were we already to Native American?
Then we were to the Native American program. Let's see, it changed in 1986. They had changed the name from the Indian Education Institute a year or two before I arrived in 86. So I want to say 84 to 86. Right in there, they changed the name.
So basically, before that time, the program was not directed by Native American. It was sort of a faculty duty to operate the program.
Right. And I think they really wanted it to be more academic focused in nature and actually have a degree in Native American studies or Indian studies or something like that. I think that was an original intent of the faculty who were involved. And then what happened was, as with state institutions, when budgets get cut or something needs to be cut, that those kinds of programs that are maybe more targeted and to special populations, you know, those seem to kind of go first. I don't know why that is, but I don't know the politics and what happened back then, but that may have, it didn't end up being that. And it ended up being, when it was a Native American program, it was really a student support services program, helping students with academic advising, course selecting the right courses, trying to get them involved in, well, not only SPILIA, but maybe other things that would hook them into the university life and give them a place. The program became kind of a home away from home a little bit. So I think probably some people were saddened that it lost its academic focus to be a minor, perhaps, and went to more on the student services side. But those things happen.
Right. So you took the helm of that program then after you spent a year in Lewiston.
Mm-hmm.
And you held that until this last year ago?
Yeah, until a year ago, 2005. Mm-hmm. I retired. I didn't retire. I put my resignation in, I think it was around June of 2005. Yeah. After 18 years here and it was a wonderful experience, a lot of growing. I did a lot of growing and learning, and it was a good time. After I took the helm, though, in 1991, we were really able, and under Dick Stenard, you know, the Dean of Students, he would put money towards the program, and he supported the program, and we got the student population enrollments built back up to, 90, let's see, I think one couple years we'd have almost 90 students. between 90 and 95 enrolled students. Some of them were distance education students who maybe didn't always come to campus, but our program, we would try to stay in touch with them and send them newsletters and just kind of keep them in the loop. So we did really well when we had financial support and that backing from the Dean of Students. We really, the program did real well.
The Native American program, does that director have faculty rank?
It has instructor rank. And so I was able to hang on to that instructor rank, although some faculty by that time, new faculty, questioned why that was the case. And, you know, it was that way in the beginning, and I fought to keep that in that position because I think that it gave, you know, it gave that person some clout, if you will, to try to, for me personally, rather than being, you know, I don't have a real huge ego to feed, but to me it meant that I could work with faculty one-on-one for the success of a Native student, just like I could work with the Dean of Students one-on-one for the success of this of the student and help, you know, kind of bridge those two very different schools, academic, you know, the faculty and the student side. So I felt it was really important.
Did you have any teaching responsibilities during the time you were here? Did you teach anything?
The only classes that I taught, I didn't have like a regular professor because I don't have the PhD or even the master's. The classes that I taught were classes like success, college success class.
This is a continuation of the history interview with Jacqueline Lino Grant. It is still July 21st, 2006. You were talking about teaching cultural courses or things like that.
Yeah, and cultural kind of awareness classes and student skill building classes, those kinds of things. So I felt very honored to be invited after some of the faculty got to know me in the nursing department, in the anthropology department, would go in and do class presentation kinds of things for, you know, different faculty on campus. So it was a good way to just, again, bridge and keep the lines of communication open for the benefit of the Native students. So.
How many Native students were on campus when you left? Well, was it larger?
It was smaller. After Dick Stannard's death, I'm trying to think of the year that he passed away. We could look that up. But it was, I want to say 1993 or 4, but that, I'm not sure on that date.
Mm-hmm.
But after his passing, the program really began to struggle. Because I didn't have the support. Well, we had an interim, and I don't know that I could say that any one person's fault, but when you have an interim, folks coming in, you're having to re-educate people about your program and about the importance and about its history and where it's been and how far it's come. That's all very, I think people like that and they honor that and they'll listen, but when it comes down to dollars, and at the same time the state of Oregon began really spiraling downhill into a downward spiral. It had been going on, but it was accelerating for just monies, and so again, not as much money could come into the program. The budgets would get shorter, so you wouldn't be able to go out and do the recruiting that you needed to do, and so there were a host of things. So I would say there was probably, I don't know, I'm guessing maybe around 55 students when I left in 05 that identified, and the club has been struggling for that leadership, still putting on the annual, you know, the annual powwow, and but not as of a close-knit group or a group as committed and dedicated to carrying on the activities of Sebelia. So that's going, you know, that had been going through a down cycle rather than an up cycle.
In terms of participation.
Yeah, and that had actually been happening several years before I left. And you try as a director, try to figure out, you know, why are those things happening? And you try to figure out, you know, getting new people in. But you kind of also have to, it has a life of its own. And so you have to kind of step back and let things happen too, and let things evolve, because you can't interfere too much. So
your recruiting duties, where would you recruit students? And I assume you were recruiting Native American mm-hmm. students for mm-hmm. campus. How did that work?
It worked, we had a great, you'd go all over Oregon. I concentrated on Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. And again, just would go to career fairs, reservation schools, went down to Chemawa a couple of times, more than a couple of times, but at Chemawa it was more of a just go and try to just be there for the students, or just try to get to know them, because they, it's changed now, but at the time I was going down there, they didn't even support the students to have enough math, for example, to get into a four-year school. So we'd talk about two-year schools and, you know, building their skills and trying to make, have students make that transition from a two-year school to a four-year school. But it didn't work the same. At the same time, you know, so recruiting was good. And there's lots of, the tribes now, the Oregon tribes, and Yakima, I know, does a great career fair every year. Nez Perce does a nice career, college and career fair. But we just try to go to those events and get students. I would try to go, take a staff member, always try to take a student. It would be nice to take a student from Burns, for example, if you were going to Burns, mm-hmm. or from Umatilla, and they could talk to students. So,
did you find recruiting efforts to be successful? Were there direct ties or direct admissions that came out of that?
I think, yes. I think, especially in the early years, there was, you know, when we came back in those early 90s, I think they were very successful. The program was strong. The campus support was strong. But when things started to change at Eastern, different faculty came on, not always being aware of the history of the program or the history of even where they had moved to, the Native people in Eastern Oregon. And so I think students, too, just late in the later 90s, and, you know, it didn't seem like our recruiting efforts were as positive or as fruitful. And, you know, I don't know really the reason for that. I'm not sure. I think it's the program pretty much tried to offer the same services, but people had left. Old faculty had left who really kind of got it, if you will. New faculty came in that were maybe not quite as aware of their environment and where they were, and maybe you didn't have the sensitivities.
Did the program, Native American program, did you have to eventually take on other programs as well as mm-hmm. NAP?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell us about that.
That, a directive from, I believe, one of the, in either the interim started introducing that, and then the last student affairs vice president. Yeah, so the success of the Native American program was really good. Even if we didn't have a lot of students, we were getting graduates out of the class. When I graduated in 1989, I was one of three. And the year before, they didn't have any, and then the year before, they had two. So it went like that for a long time, through probably the late 70s and early 80s. They'd get one or two or three. In the 80s and the early 90s, we were having 7, 8 graduates. And so the program was really doing its job. It was really being, the students were being successful, and the program could take, at least own a part of that. I think faculty also owned a part of that, because there was a lot of faculty who would call me and say, you know what, I haven't seen so-and-so in class for a couple of days, can you follow up and see if they're okay? And so if I hadn't seen them in the office, that was a real red flag. So I would go and call them at their home and try to run by and, you know, just check on them. Sometimes they had to leave to go home for unexpected business and just couldn't tell anybody. So, you know, faculty did that in those years. When we had to, I think what Eastern wanted was they wanted success for all of their minority students. And so we took on the Hispanic, first it was Hispanic students, and I tried to tell the university leaders that this is great, I support the idea, I support education for students, but I said there's some differences between Native students and Hispanic students, and I don't know if we can lump them all together. The Micronesian students were another group, Pacific Islanders were another group. I think the Native students had more in common, if you will, with some of the Pacific Islanders and the Micronesian students, and I'm all for building cultural competency across groups of people, but the university never took my advice to give each group kind of their own little space so that people could feel autonomous and come together when they wanted to come together, not be forced together into a place. And they never, either there wasn't enough money or there wasn't enough space or something, and you know, I was asked again and again, write us this proposal for that. And pretty soon I just got tired of recycling the proposals because it just wasn't going to happen. So
now, did this, this seems like additional responsibility for your main job. Well, did this come about because of the budget cuts that were coming? Didn't they have their own directors?
I did take on the extra responsibility. I got some raises and promotions along that time, you know, cost of living kinds of things, and got some promotions, raises to do that. So that part was, you know, that part was okay, but the funding to actually have enough space for the student, more students, or more computers for the students where you could kind of have them in a central location where the students might want to join. I think it's a goal of Eastern's to do that, but they don't come across with the money. It's a lot of talk and, you know, the funds weren't there. Actually, student government was a big push of that. We got the Multicultural Student Center over in Hoke, and that was really helpful because that became a spot a little bit larger. People could come and go. They didn't feel they could have meetings there. It was kind of open. And really, it was student government who helped Spilia get that space for all of the groups. And Spilia was happy to kind of help spearhead that along, I think, and see that happen. But, like, did they have an office or did they have their own director or coordinator? I suggested it and urged the university to do that, but they just couldn't find the funding to do that, I suppose. So.
What things did you do in your leadership to help Spilia with the annual powwow when you became the director, and then of course it was a responsibility of yours, of your program?
Of the program, I think early on when we had good club participation and strong leadership as the president, vice president, secretary, treasurer, the program and the club worked really closely together. And we would help with all of the technical assistance, all of the funding to mail out letters of invitation, make the flyers, keep the database so you had a mailing of folks, help advertise and market, which is always a weak area, but that was one of the ways I think we did try to help with that. And then just cooking the meal and being there and, you know, helping. The last year, the 2 years before I helped the Spilia president, we actually wrote a grant to the Wild Horse Foundation together, and that was funded. And then, of course, the students move on, and so when the report came time to come, that was the director's job to make sure that report got done on time and that the monies were spent how we told them we were going to spend them. So, kind of oversight in that way.
My perception is that the powwow here at Eastern is actually a well-known event. around the state.
I do.
On other campuses, mm-hmm. and most of the tribes I've been involved with know about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually kind of the link for them, and you know, for Eastern Oregon University,
mm-hmm.
is that
mm-hmm.
power.
Yes.
So, do you see your, Native American alumni from Eastern at this? Are there regular people that you must know, people who return every year?
Yeah, there are people who return every year, and alumni who can get up here, people who supported it, went to school here, and it is well known across the state for those reasons, because we have students who've moved to different places. So it is a time to get together. I think it's just from a, because I came back this last year, and I think we need to build that more as alumni. More alums need to get involved and maybe build that up. And I'm not sure exactly how that will evolve, but I know that there's a core group of people who would probably support that idea. I have to say, just, I think there's probably some things I could have done better as a director to get more alumni involved, but just having too many responsibilities and maybe not enough time to cultivate that while I was in that position is, you know, that's probably a regret that I would have. But I think it could still be done if people wanted to
do. How do you get the drummers and singers and the MC and the other people who play very vital roles during a powwow?
Yes. We, Umatilla has been our, because they're our closest reservation and group of tribal people, we usually try to get our MC identified, and then our MC will help us with those other components, the drummers and the lead singers, and sometimes we know lead men and men dancers and women dancers that we'll ask. Sometimes it'll be alum, but we do depend on our MC to help us with that. When I came, different individuals have done that most recently. Fred Hill has been MCing for the powwow, and he's wonderful and really does go out of his way to help us. And our host drum, you know, this last year, Howitt Me Singers, they were wonderful, and I think they helped too to kind of promote, and we usually have a nice turnout of drums at the powwow, and lots of young dancers, which I'm just so thrilled with, because one of the things I think about that we've tried to do it, the years that I was at Eastern and the years before I came, is to marry the idea of, yes, you need a formal education in today's world, but you also need your cultural education, and you need to be culturally knowledgeable. Not all of us know about our rituals or our ceremonies, and I think that piece is really important. Indian people need those components, I think. Whether they want to go out and start dancing, or that's a personal choice, but they need to understand the importance of both of those things, because for, I think, Indian people who succeed in this environment of a university are strong in themselves as Indian people first. So when I see the young people out there dancing and learning and practicing their traditions, you know, hopefully they'll all be college students someday or be in a program where they're doing something, but they'll have that cultural piece. So I think, to me, that was a unique thing about the powwow at Eastern, is, and the people who came here were parents of their students who came here, you know, elderly people who had sent their children here, and Eastern took really good care of their children while they were here, and they were, you know, giving back actually to the university. I don't know if the university gets that, but the Indian people get it.
Right.
So,
so that's been, actually that program is a great ambassador for Eastern, whether the administration knows it or not.
Exactly. You asked me about recruiting earlier, and I forgot to mention that we always treated our powwow like a show. We wanted people to come and see our materials and look over Eastern and have a good time. And we really wanted some of the faculty would come and participate and be involved. But towards the later years, the administration didn't really kind of ever make that connection, that the importance of being there and going around and meeting the people, introducing themselves and shaking their hands and, you know, meeting the people. That's just custom where in at home, any home, any reservation.
So no administrators really attend on a formal basis then?
Not recently. So,
is there a particular format for the powwow,
a program, or the way
it operates?
Yeah, but generally, some years the students were ambitious and they wanted to do two-day powwows or two grand entries, and we tried those. I really tried to let the students learn as they went along and tried not to discourage any of their ideas. So we tried those things, but we went back to, this year they went back to the old format, which is a one grand entry at 7 in the evening, and we'd always have the meal at 5, and so that'd be a community meal. The salmon, Umatilla Tribe, the fisheries department has been donating salmon for years. Before that, I'd gone to the elders' program, and they donated salmon. Elsie and Emma Farrow, when the first year or two I met them, Elsie told me, he said, you come over to the elders and ask for fish for your powwow. And they supported the education program here for years and years, like many of the elders did. Especially, I got to know the ones from Umatilla a little bit better than Yakima and Nez Perce country just because of the location and could travel there easy.
Well, Emma Farrow and I were on the Umatilla Tribal Education Board together. She chaired that board for years, I know, and she had children who came to Eastern.
Yes, she did.
Mike and his wife,
Lou,
came to Eastern.
Mm-hmm.
So how about some success stories, you know, of some of the natives, you know, we're not looking for particular names or anything like that, but maybe talking in general about what are the successes of the program, the things that we know the powwow, that this
definitely
is something they do well. It's a perpetual event. Doesn't seem like it's going to die off anytime soon.
No, I don't think so. I think there'll be people who will come in and stay involved with that. Yeah. So, success stories. Oh my gosh, there's been a lot of success stories. I think students who have received their degrees and are teaching. I've got more that I know of from my tenure there. There's about 3 in Alaska, in different places teaching. And we have, of course, Lorena Thompson. She was in this program, and she's done wonderful. She's went to back home.
She's the HR director for Wild Horse Casino.
It's hard to say the successes, I guess, sure. Michael, without the names. But there's just some, even the students who didn't maybe quite complete their degree have gone back to their reservations, a lot of them, and are working in holding down good jobs and helping to be good leaders in their tribal community. We've got a teacher, one young man who I just met when I came, and I can't remember if we were both new in 1986, but he was a lot younger than me, and I really had to do a lot of guiding with him. Because he was over here kind of a ways away from Nez Perce country, kind of homesick, but a very bright young man. He came over to play baseball and did very well, but then realized, well, I'm not going to make a major league baseball, go into the majors. So he wanted to go into teaching, and he didn't finish at Eastern, but he did finish over at, I think at LCCC. LCSC, Lewis Clark State College, and then went on to get a master's, and he's teaching over in Nez Perce country. And so I'm always really happy to have those native teacher folks out there, because there aren't enough of them, and yeah, we really need them. Our young people, not just our native young people, but our Anglo young people, need them in their classrooms. They need to build those relationships with native teachers and native people, so they can. That's how cultural understanding is built. But lots and lots of success stories. I think students. Then we have students who still support this. But just a month ago, I ran into Michael Clements from Warm Springs, and him and his brother Rudy Clements were both at Eastern Oregon University, Eastern Oregon EOC, I think, Eastern Oregon College at that time. Rudy has passed away this past year.
I remember that.
Yeah, and Michael, I ran into him at Grand Ronde. And we had a nice chat, and Michael and I got to know each other through the program. He was at Eastern, and when I came on, the unique thing about being a part of the Native American program and the history is that you could get on the phone and ask people for help and ask folks, what should I do, how should I go about this, and people who had been here, and I did a lot of that, going back to those folks, and Emma Farrow, Elsie Farrow, Lenora Spino, the Craigs, Priscilla Craig, and Fillmore Craig. I mean, I could just name, I haven't named them all, but there's too many to name.
Sure.
But those people really helped me in those early years to kind of, what do the students need? What will work for the Indian community? And so when we talk about successes, we can't ignore the fact of how those elders played such a key role in those students' successes. Even the students who went off to Alaska, you know, who didn't know any Umatilla people, those Umatilla people or those Nez Perce people have really contributed to their success. So I think it's, when I think about success, I think about the people who started the program and who supported it all those years, and then the students.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the Native American Mentoring Program. Mm. That got started during your tenure here. Mm-hmm. What is that about, first of all?
Well, we really realized we needed to be recruiting. It came out of a recruiting effort, and we got this, the way that the admissions office, nothing against the admissions office, but it's in the admissions office, they go out and they'll talk to the seniors and the juniors and the seniors. And I would say, well, that's not going to work with our communities. We've got to go talk to the younger kids. And so we started at the middle school level. We realized middle school. In fact, it was Michael Clements. And I've been involved with other organizations. I chair the Oregon Indian Coalition for Postsecondary Ed. And through that organization, got involved with the Oregon Indian Education Association, the Northwest Summit, the Affiliated Tribes has an education piece, National Indian Education Association. By getting involved with these different groups and associations, Native people realize we've got to get our kids at the middle school level, because if we don't, we might lose them as they go make that transition from middle school to high school. And what happens, or what's been happening, is they start falling behind in their credits for whatever reason. Then by the time they are legal age of dropping out of school, sometimes they'll just see no hope. There's too many credits gone by. I can never catch up. So I'll just drop out. So we would have, a high dropout rate. So that this recruiting effort, the mentoring program, was designed to work with those younger kids. And at first it was just Native college students with Native middle school students at Sunridge.
Over in Pendleton.
And
Sunridge Middle School.
Sunridge Middle School in Pendleton, Oregon. And the principal there, I wish I could think of his name. Right now he's down in Idaho. But he was a big supporter of us and let us into his school, and the tribe supported us, and the college supported us. So we had three organizations working together I had convinced him this was a good thing to do, and we'd gotten a grant. Our first grant was from the Oregon. Jim Malmstrom helped write that first grant, and it was from the Oregon Juvenile Advisory Board. It has a longer name than that, but from the estate organization. And that program is just designed to be a mentor to a middle school Native student, but it's grown on the eastern side because then it was so successful, we had students wanting to be mentors to these kids. And so we wrote for more money, we got a federal grant. So I think, you know, that is the program, this good concept, and if we can track these kids through, the whole idea, stay connected.
Now, are you still working with just Native American middle school students, or have you branched out into other cultures?
Well, I think, I'm not sure what they did last year. When I left, it was just the Native American middle school students, but that doesn't mean, I think we were trying to branch out to the high school. We wanted to get a program going over at the Niktiawe Community School, the charter school on the reservation, as well as at the Pendleton High School. And the Pendleton High School, they were a little tougher cookie to crack in a lot of ways, but I still think it's worth trying to, you know, bring them along and sell the idea that this would be good. But if we can't, then, you know, I think they, and I'm not sure what they did this last year because I was gone for that year.
My understanding is they did make connections with Niktiawe.
Oh, good.
And the charter school. So what do these mentors do when they spend time? And what's the routine? They spend a specific amount of time with a Native American student over there. What are they expected to do?
Yeah, when I was here, we were traveling over there once every 2 weeks for an on-site visit, and we'd all meet in the cafeteria, and we would try to do some icebreakers at the beginning to kind of group things. And then kind of let the students go off, you know, in a little area of the cafeteria. And sometimes they would be visiting. Sometimes they would be working on homework. We tried to encourage at least some of our visits to be academic focused so that the students, you know, had that experience. We did crafts. Sometimes we do crafts. We always tried to share food of some sort or a snack. But the mentor's job was to be a friend. You know, listen, be non-judgmental. We did a lot of training of our mentors so that they could, especially, well, we didn't have to train so much the Native mentors, but we certainly realized our training need to pick up when we got international students and Anglo mentors. They needed more support from us to work with their Native student because their heart was in the right place, but sometimes they were afraid, will I offend my mentee or how will I, you know, what will I want to do my very best job. And so the most dedicated group of students I've worked with for a long time is that mentor group. But yeah, they were just expected to be a friend and to be there and just make... I always wanted it to be a weekly contact, and I don't know, they may have done it this year, but an on-site visit every 2 weeks with an email or a telephone call or something on the off week. But that off week has been harder to manage and make up because, I don't know, it just...